crosswalk.
This is a special live report from ABC News. I'm Don Fisher in New York. President Nixon is about to address the nation and is expected to announce his resignation as 37th President of the United States. Vice President Gerald Ford expected to become the nation's new chief executive in swearing-in ceremonies in Washington tomorrow. President Nixon is believed to have made the decision to resign following a meeting with GOP congressional leaders late yesterday afternoon. The leaders apparently told the president he could count on no more than 15 senators who would support his position to remain in office. President Nixon would thus become the first president in American history to resign from office in the 198-year history of the Republic. Just prior to tonight's address, the president met with Democratic and Republican congressional leaders.
Good evening.
And here is the president.
This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office, where so many decisions have been made that shaped the history of this nation. Each time I have done so to discuss with you some matter that I believe affected the national interest. In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation. Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. As long as there was such a base, I felt strongly that it was necessary to see the constitutional process through to its conclusion, that to do otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged. I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad. To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office. As I recall the high hopes for America with which we began this second term, I feel a great sadness that I will not be here in this office working on your behalf to achieve those hopes in the next 2.5 years. But in turning over direction of the government to Vice President Ford, I know, as I told the nation when I nominated him for that office 10 months ago, that the leadership of America will be in good hands. In passing this office to to the Vice President, I also do so with a profound sense of the weight of responsibility that will fall on his shoulders tomorrow, and therefore of the understanding, the patience, the cooperation he will need from all Americans. As he assumes that responsibility, he will deserve the help and the support of all of us. As we look to the future, the first essential is to begin healing the wounds of this nation, to put the bitterness and divisions of the recent past behind us, and to rediscover those shared ideals that lie at the heart of our strength and unity as a great and as a free people. By taking this action, I hope that I will have hastened the start of that process of healing which is so desperately needed in America. I regret deeply any injuries that may have been done in the course of the events that led to this decision. I would say only that if some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made in what I believed at the time to be the best interest of the nation. To those who have stood with me during these past difficult months, to my family, my friends, the many others who joined in supporting my cause because they believed it was right, I will be eternally grateful for your support. And to those who have not felt able to give me your support, let me say, I leave with no bitterness toward those who have opposed me, because all of us in the final analysis have been concerned with the good of the country, however our judgments might differ. So let us all now join together in affirming that common commitment and in helping our new president succeed for the benefit of all Americans. I shall leave this office with regret at not completing my term, but with gratitude for the privilege of serving as your president for the past 5.5 years. These years have been a momentous time in the history of our nation and the world. They have been a time of achievement in which we can all be proud. Achievements that represent the shared efforts of the administration, the Congress, and the people. But the challenges ahead are equally great, and they too will require the support and the efforts of the Congress and the people working in cooperation with the new administration. We have ended America's longest war, but in the work of securing a lasting peace in the world, the goals ahead are even more far-reaching and more difficult. We must complete a structure of peace so that it will be said of this generation, our generation of Americans, by the people of all nations, not only that we ended one war, but that we prevented future wars. We have unlocked the doors that for a quarter of a century stood between the United States and the People's Republic of China. We must now ensure that the one quarter of the world's people who live in the People's Republic of China will be and remain not our enemies, but our friends. In the Middle East, 100 million people in the Arab countries, many of whom have considered us their enemy for nearly 20 years, now look on us as their friends. We must continue to build on that friendship so that peace can settle at last over the Middle East, and so that the cradle of civilization will not become its grave. Together with the Soviet Union, we have made the crucial breakthroughs that that have begun the process of limiting nuclear arms. But we must set as our goal not just limiting, but reducing and finally destroying these terrible weapons so that they cannot destroy civilization, and so that the threat of nuclear war will no longer hang over the world and the people. We have opened a new relation with the Soviet Union. We must continue to develop and expand that new relationship so that the two strongest nations of the world will live together in cooperation rather than confrontation. Around the world, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, in the Middle East, there are millions of people who live in terrible poverty, even starvation. We must keep as our goal turning away from production for war and expanding production for peace so that people everywhere on this earth can at last look forward in their children's time, if not in our own time, to having the necessities for a decent life. Here in America, we are fortunate that most of our people have not only the blessings of liberty, but also the means to live full and good, and by the world's standards, even abundant lives. We must press on, however, toward a goal not only of more and better jobs, but of full opportunity for every American. And of what we are striving so hard right now to achieve, prosperity without inflation. For more than a quarter of a century in public life, I have shared in the turbulent history of this era. I have fought for what I believed in. I have tried, to the best of my ability, to discharge those duties and meet those responsibilities that were entrusted to me. Sometimes I have succeeded, and sometimes I have failed. But always, I have taken heart from what Theodore Roosevelt once said about the man in the arena whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, because there is not effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deed, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumphs of high achievement, and who, at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. I pledge to you tonight that as long as I have a breath of life in my body, I shall continue in that spirit. I shall continue to work for the great causes to which I have been dedicated throughout my years as a congressman, a senator, vice president, and president. The cause of peace, not just for America, but among all nations. Prosperity, justice, and opportunity for all of our people. There is one cause, above all, to which I have been devoted and to which I shall always be devoted for as long as I live. When I first took the oath of office as president 5.5 years ago, I made this sacred commitment to consecrate my office, my energies, and all the wisdom I can summon to the cause of peace among nations. I've done my very best in all the days since to be true to that pledge. As a result of these efforts, I am confident that the world is a safer place today, not only for the people of America, but for the people of all nations. And that all of our children have a better chance than before of living in peace rather than dying in war. This, more than anything, is what I hoped to achieve when I sought the presidency. This, more than anything, is what I hope will be my legacy to you, to our country, as I leave the presidency. To have served in this office is to have felt a very personal sense of kinship with each and every American. In leaving it, I do so with this prayer. May God's grace be with you in all the days ahead.
President Nixon has just resigned, effective noon tomorrow, when Vice President Ford will be sworn into office in Washington. In a nationwide address to the nation tonight, President Nixon said he had no longer a political base in Congress. He said his family urged him to stay and fight, but because of that lack of congressional base, the president thought he had to step down. He said leadership will be in good hands, in the hands of now Vice President Ford, and he thanked those who supported him in the past. And President Nixon called on everyone to join him in helping the new president, Vice President Ford, who will take office at noontime tomorrow in the Oval Office at the White House. Now let's go to Washington and our colleague David Garcia, who has with him several congressmen with some reaction to the president's resignation. David?
Yes, we have three members of the House Judiciary Committee with us tonight. Charles Sandman, Republican of New Jersey, Walter Flowers, Democrat of Alabama, and John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan. Gentlemen, I'd like to spend the first few moments with you in reaction to the president's speech tonight. I was very much struck by the tone of it, the listing of his foreign policy and domestic accomplishments. Perhaps it could be said that it sounded something of a campaign speech almost. Mr. Sandman, start with you, sir.
Well, I was very impressed with the president's sincerity. I expected him to say about what he did. I said at the outset that I believe that whatever decision he would make would be one which he thought was in the best interest of the country. And this he has done. In fact, I urged this kind of a decision in the letter that I sent to him on the day that we received the tapes of June 23, because I could see nothing short of a tie-up for a long period of time in both the House and the Senate, and that wouldn't be in the best interest of the country.
Mr. Flowers.
Well, I am struck by the speech, frankly. I don't see really how anyone could hardly disagree with any of the statements that were made in it. The operative part of it, if I may borrow that phrase, as I saw it, was his statement that we need to begin healing the wounds of this nation, and that his action does hasten the start of that process. The tone of his talk here tonight, the manner in which it was delivered, without rancor, without any blame upon anyone, I thought it was magnificent, frankly.
Mr. Conyers.
Well, we've heard a dramatic farewell address. There's no question about that. It was very evenly tempered. There was earlier speculation among some of my colleagues whether it would be a bitter, a vitriolic departure, and it was not. It was very careful not to make any admissions of guilt with regard to the impeachment proceedings that are, of course, in some question from this point on. And so I must say quite candidly, it accomplished its purpose in that it allowed the president to remove himself in the interests of the nation, blaming an erosion of congressional support, when I think one might more precisely indicate that it was an erosion of the support of the American people, which was, of course, reflected in the institution of the Congress. And so I join my colleagues in their comments, but point out that it was a quite politically strategic address that still leaves the major questions of this day unanswered.
You mentioned the impeachment proceedings, Mr. Conyers, and in chats with various members on the Hill today, there was talk that unless the president addresses himself to the articles of impeachment and accepts guilt on himself, then perhaps the impeachment proceedings should proceed. What are your feelings on that, Mr. Sandman?
No, I think that would be aimless. It would be much the same as shooting a dead horse, so to speak, and I can't see what can be accomplished along that line. Our purpose was, number one, as a Judiciary Committee, to make an inquiry into the facts as to whether or not sufficient grounds existed for the removal from office of the president. We found that did exist. And the ultimate part of that job has now been accomplished by the president's resignation, so I can see no reason to proceed.
One other point, Mr. Flowers, which I hope you would address yourself to, the thought perhaps that the president was hounded from office.
Well, I agree with Charles in what he said, Congressman Sandman, that there is little point, in my judgment anyway, in proceeding with the impeachment process. I would have to differ with my good friend from Michigan to some extent, Mr. Conyers, because I do not think in totality was the impeachment, the pending impeachment, the voice of the American people speaking out. In some instances, I know that was not altogether true in my own, because my district was firmly behind the president, and I think, at least that's the way I read it prior to the actual vote, and I think there are many cases of that, but and on a nationwide basis, I do not differ with the gentleman from Michigan.
We would like to, Mr. Conyers, we'll be right back with you in just a moment. We'd like to move now to ABC correspondent Jerry Landay at the White House. Jerry?
Over here, people were doing what people throughout the country were doing, even though we're, of course, paid to cover the news. We're citizens, too, and patriots. People were glued to radios and glued to television sets in the large press room. The temperature in there up to about 80 to 85 degrees. Not a sound throughout the entire 16 minutes of the president's speech. The president did indeed look as serene to many of us as those behind the scenes have been describing him. At one point, however, it seemed to us that a bit of essential emotion, perhaps almost tears, could be noticed when he said that he hoped that by taking the action he did, he hoped he would hasten the process of healing. There's one question that he raises, and conceivably some of you gentlemen over there might address yourself to it if you haven't already, and that is that he said that he failed to maintain a political base in the Congress, and yet he said nothing about the political base it's necessary for a president to maintain among the people. And I wonder what comments some of you might have.
Just a few moments ago, Jerry, we were talking about that subject. Congressman Conyers of Michigan brought it up. But perhaps, Mr. Conyers, if you would rephrase what you had said at that point, and then again move on to the subject of the advisability of proceeding with the impeachment.
Well, simply put, the president was, of course, correct that his congressional base had eroded. But we as members of Congress did not seek nor invite or solicit impeachment proceedings. Now, those proceedings and the mood in the Congress that required that they be brought was a direct result of his firing of the special prosecutor. And when that happened, of course, we had some 60 resolutions of impeachment that hit the floor. That wasn't congressmen reacting. They received several millions of telegrams and letters, unprecedented in the history of the House of Representatives, that moved them to that point. Now, of course, we're not going to continue the impeachment proceedings. There's no spirit for it among even those who felt that those proceedings would have more clearly resolved the question of this administration. There is no vindictiveness in the House, and even those who have most consistently fought the president's policies in Congress are united with his defenders that proceedings under the impeachment provisions be discontinued. Now, the question, of course, is what about the potential criminal prosecutions that well may follow, because impeachment is not itself a criminal proceeding?
Well, now, some members of Congress are saying that the question of prosecution is not something for Congress to address itself to. Mr. Flowers, you were disagreeing with Mr. Conyers on...
Well, I disagree about the erosion of public support having brought about the impeachment process gaining the stage that it did, because I think there's some very pertinent facts which run counter to that. First of all, the whole spirit of our committee in its deliberations was a spirit of independence of public opinion, a spirit of heeding our constitutional duty. And I believe that's, in fact, the way it was carried through. And sure, an erosion of congressional support, but only to fight the impeachment process. He still enjoyed a great deal of congressional support for many of his programs, but he was unable, in my judgment, to carry that forward with the necessary leadership that's required from the executive branch to the Congress.
Gentlemen, as of noon tomorrow, we'll have a new president, Gerald Ford. What about Mr. Ford as the president, his relations with Congress? What are you expecting, Mr. Sandman?
I think that Jerry is going to be a good president. I've known him a long time, and I enjoy a warm friendship with him. He certainly has had sufficient exposure to the problems of the world. He's been in Congress some 22 years. He's been a leader in Congress. He's been number two man in the nation, as second only to the chief executive for some 10 months. And he has a good approach, I believe, to the job that faces him, which is massive.
Mr. Flowers.
Well, I'd maybe go a little further than my friend from New Jersey. I agree with what the president said tonight. And I have said this often, he has accomplished many things that our country will long remember. But perhaps the greatest legacy that he will leave us is the current vice president and tomorrow's president, Gerald Ford.
Mr. Conyers.
Of course, Mr. Ford is from Michigan. And he's disappointed the people in Detroit and in urban communities across this nation, not only since he's been in the White House, but during and throughout his entire congressional career. As a matter of fact, he was replaced by a Democrat in one of the key elections of the year. Now, I think it's incumbent upon the president-to-be to recognize that he is a part now of what is in effect for the first time in our history, a coalition government. He has never been elected to the vice presidency or to the presidency. He now has the prerogative to select a vice president. And I would hope that all of my colleagues who whose advice he solicits and respects will encourage him not to make a partisan decision as to who is going to share the vice presidency with him during this next period of time, because he has a responsibility to bring someone on, and far be it from me to give him any suggestions on this subject, but he has a responsibility to bring someone on who makes it clear by who that person will be that he is caretaking the executive. He has no powers as a duly elected spokesman of some 200 million people, and he should be very, very careful to make sure that he not necessarily selects a Democrat, but selects someone who will, by the choice, will indicate to the nation that he wants to pull us together and keep us together until the next elections.
Of course, now that is one of the big guessing games in Washington right now. Who is going to be the vice president? Any preferences, choices, Mr. Sandman?
I haven't any choice, and that's for sure. He hasn't asked me. And any number of the people who have been mentioned, I think, would be worthwhile suggestions. I could support almost any of them. I was interviewed on one of the stations the other day, and the interviewer posed a couple of names, the first one of which was Rockefeller. Since I live in a neighboring state, of course, I would be very happy with Rockefeller. I could say the same thing about George Bush. I could say the same thing about any number of the others. John and I will have something to say, and so will Walter, about who it's going to be, that's for sure. Because he's going to go through the acid test as Jerry did, and I'm sure we'll come up with the right decision.
And it was an acid test, too.
It was.
I think that's one of the beautiful things about this man that'll be our president tomorrow. He went through the most searching, intensive investigation that any public official has ever done, and he came through, in my judgment, standing tall and straight, and that's what the country's got to look forward to tomorrow, to help bring us through this terrible crisis that we find ourselves in here tonight.
The acid test, you gentlemen referring to, being the investigation hearings by the House Judiciary Committee, who will be questioning the new president's choice for a new vice president. Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for your time this evening. We're now going to switch back to New York and correspondent Tim O'Donnell.
Thank you, David. And we might point out that President Nixon will leave the White House tomorrow morning, go by helicopter to Andrews Air Force Base, and then board Air Force One with his family for the flight to San Clemente, their home at San Clemente, California. The president will be in the air at the time that Vice President Ford is sworn in as President of the United States. That'll be tomorrow at noon. And ABC, of course, will bring you live coverage of the swearing-in ceremony tomorrow. At ABC's London Bureau right now, correspondent Jerry King is in the studios. And, Jerry, what do you have to tell us from your end?
The presidential resignation, Don, came about 2 o'clock in the morning here. A lot of people, of course, would have been staying up late to listen and watch the speech. It was carried live on the two British television networks, Radio Independent and the BBC here both carried it. I think the president probably made a lot of friends. The initial reaction of the BBC announcer reporting from Washington right after the speech, his summation of it, was that it was highly emotional and perhaps one of the best speeches that the president has ever made. The instant reaction of some of the presidential critics has been that there was very little in the way of contrition showing. But the initial thing here that will worry a lot of people is, what is Mr. Ford? He's not a very well-known person here. He's an unknown quantity. He's known primarily as being a dull, plodding, unsensational person. And Lyndon Johnson's comment on him about playing football a little too often without his helmet is probably one of the most quoted lines here about the 38th president of the United States. And a lot of people here will be wondering just exactly where Mr. Ford will lead America now. There is, I think, a general feeling of relief throughout Europe that the Watergate scandal now appears to be drawing to a close. There will be a lot of relief over that. Europe feels that there are a lot of things that have left to be solved and are looking to the new president to solve them for them.
Jerry, what kind of coverage had the Washington story of the last 2 days gotten in Britain?
Try it again.
Jerry, we're having some trouble. I wonder if you could tell us what kind of coverage has the Washington drama of the last few days gotten in London?
Monday's speech by the president to suggest that he should tender his resignation. I think people here are perhaps more aware now of what's going on in the United States politically than they ever have been for perhaps any time in their history here.
Was there much talk about the fact that impeachment, which the process was begun and then, of course, cut short, the fact that that was a product of British jurisprudence?
I think most people are rather secretly proud of the fact that this has its origins way back in Britain, but I think a lot of people still don't understand exactly what impeachment means. They knew the president was going to go if the thing went on through the trial in the Senate. But they weren't quite sure why or how or in what way or just what would happen. But I think generally there is a kind of a pride here that the thing has its roots in British jurisprudence.